I'm Brian Wilson.
I'm Mark Rankin.
Welcome to In the Between.
Brian, do you remember when we first decided that we wanted to do a podcast?
Yeah, I do. We've been talking about doing something like this for quite a while, but we didn't really know what the theme is going to be. So I think when we were working on the film, James Super Chicken Johnson, Life in Blues, it really struck us how many interesting stories there are about people who have multiple creative avenues and multiple careers going on at the same time.
Yeah, and very much like you and I, because as much as we enjoy being filmmakers, we've still got our day jobs and we have to juggle our creative projects like so many other people. And our very first guest who we asked, a very old friend of mine, Raul Beneja, he certainly embodies the in-between as he spent most of his career not only as a professional actor, but also as a professional musician.
Yeah, I think Raul was a really special first choice for us because he was very instrumental as well in launching our film. He was the one who suggested to you that you bring Super Chicken up to Vancouver to do some shows. And from there, you know, it all kind of took off. And here we are many years later.
Yeah, so true. I mean, when we were touring the film and doing various Q&As at screenings, people would always ask us where we got the idea to do a film on Super Chicken. And we always, you know, gave credit to Raul. So it's very fitting that he would be our first guest. And it's a very interesting time in his career. He's been playing music with his band Raul the Big Time for over 25 years. But most importantly, he's been very recently nominated for a Screen Actors Award for the hit show on Crave, The Trades. So very, very timely and very cool that we got to sit down with him and talk about his career and all about his in-between, which is being a professional musician and being a professional actor, or as he so rightfully calls himself, a performer.
Exactly. So let's get to it and hear what Raul has to say.
First, actually, the very first thing, Raul, before, you know, is to actually congratulate you, dude, on the Canadian Screen Award nomination.
Thank you so much.
Well
Thank
done.
You. Thank you
well
so
done.
Much.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
29 years in the making. You know, I've done Canadian television for 29 years, and I have 140 IMDb credits. And among my friends, when I say, oh, it's my first nomination, people are like, no, you come on. Like, everybody's got one of them. And I'm like, no. In fact, I do have one previous Gemini nomination, but that's for the Hamlet solo documentary. And that was as a producer, oddly enough.
So oh, that's interesting.
There you go.
You've been nominated for Trades. How was the experience of working on that? I mean, I know you've done comedy before, but this is a lot more, I guess, more broad comedy than something you've been involved in.
It's definitely the raunchiest show I've ever been in. I remember when I read the script, and not only was my character kind of like a perpetually hungover alcoholic, but also when I read the golf episode, and just before he gets sent to rehab, his sort of bottoming out moment is when he's taking a shit in the 18th hole. I thought, yeah, I don't know if that's ever even happened on Canadian television, let alone ever happened to me. And then the other highlights would be having, Tom Green talk about my big brown snake while I was taking a wee against a tree. So yeah, it's not like any other show I've ever been on, but it's been a lot of fun. And it's a really incredible sort of Canadian team, you know, of like, it's got all these veterans and people who've been on all these different, like there's somebody from, well, I mean, there's Tom Green and Patrick McKenna, who was on the Red Green show, and Traitors 1,000 years ago, which was like the second TV show I'd ever been on. You know, Anastasia Phillips from Moonshine, Susan Kent from This Hour is 22 Minutes. It's Tara Spencer-Darren from Corner Gas, Rob Wells, of course, from the Trailer Park Boys, our lead, Daniel from Letterkenny. So, you know, and this year, Dave Lawrence from FUBAR, you know, which is that great sort of rock and roll mockumentary franchise from Calgary. So, you know, just everywhere you turned, you were like, oh, wow, it's somebody from like one of these sort of legendary Canadian comedy shows. And we're all sort of on this sort of dysfunctional all-star team. So for me, it's like I've done some comedies, and I suppose, you know, Train 48 was kind of comedic. A show I did for CBC called The Best Laid Plans was comedic.
Right,
but for
yeah.
me, it's kind of a mix, you know, like I do comedy and drama and I just do whatever I can. So, but no, it's been very cool to be part of that.
It sounds like kind of a dream team and just a real celebration of everyone's work, not just yours. And so I guess, you know, the award is obviously for you, but it's also for all those people have done all that amazing work over the years.
Well, in fact, I was nominated myself for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy, but even better in a way is that the show was also nominated for Best Ensemble in a Comedy, which for me is really how it goes. You know, a comedy, a good comedy is a team sport, you know, even, a comedy needs a straight man in every scene or a straight woman and all that stuff. So the Ensemble Award, I think for a lot of us, Anastasia Phillips nominated for Lead, Patrick McKenna for Guest Star. So, but I think for any of us, it's the fact that we got nominated as an ensemble is sort of more satisfying because it really is a great group of people all working together to make each other look good and to have fun. Also, you know, the first season we shot, which is the one we're nominated for, you know, that was just at the tail end of COVID and it was during the strike, the actor strikes. We were all just feeling so lucky that we had a job. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 2023, and we shot it in the summertime in Nova Scotia, and it was beautiful, and it was kind of like we were in this weird summer camp. It was like a summer camp TV show, and nobody was really having to worry about other conflicts and other shows or flying in and out or working on other things. So it was kind of this period where we were all really grateful to have work because so many of our friends all across North America didn't. So we all felt super lucky. And then also, you know, we were making this new show and all these new characters and this new thing together. Like, it's very tight schedule. We had one director shoot all 8 episodes at once at the same time. Wow. We block shot Warren Sonoda, block shot 8 half-hour episodes all at once, which is completely mad. And it was very cool.
Is that a difference you find between, you know, working on a Canadian show and working on an American show, that you do have, would you necessarily have an American director blocking 8 episodes?
No, most I've ever done on an American show is have, you know, one director do 2 episodes at a time, not 8. And even on a Canadian show, I don't think I've ever done a show where one director's done all 8 all at the same time. There's always been some sort of shared load. And in our case, it was really because the budget was tight, the time was very tight, and we had to shoot locations out and then move on to the next location. So it was very much location based. It's not a show that's shot a ton in studio. It's almost all locations. So, you know, if they're in the lunchroom, then we shoot all the lunchroom scenes between episodes 1 and 8 over the course of 3 or 4 days. And then we move to the next place, you know?
Yeah, no, sure.
So no, that was very different. And like I say, I've never seen a director. I mean, Warren would just walk around with this giant binder that would sort of make his body double over because it was so huge and full. And he'd just be flipping through pages. He had it all ordered out in some way. And again, then this in season 2, which is on TV now or on Crave now, he shot 7 of 8. And our series creator and showrunner, Ryan, he made his television directing debut by directing a bottle episode, you know, which is like when you have a show, when a show kind of has a self-contained, stylized episode. You know, some shows it's a musical or whatever. He went for kind of 80s horror. And so episode 4 is this very stylistic episode. And Ryan, our series creator, that's the first episode of television he's ever directed. So that was very cool. And it's very successful, I thought, in terms of what he pulled off. So, but Warren did the other 7 again. You know, at the end of that season, he was like, I don't know if I'll ever do that again. And then this year he did 7. I was like, that's barely taking a shift off. And he was around for most of 7 because he was a mentor and kind of like a backup guy for our series creator who was doing it for the first time. So, you know, that's the vibe around there. It's a real sort of team thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a real corporate vibe. It's very homespun. And now that Ryan has sort of proven himself and it was the most viewed show on Crave.
Yeah, I saw that. It's great.
He's now been given the reins, you know, and so it's kind of nice in a season 2 for someone who is kind of new at this to be given more say and control, you know, as opposed to, well, you've got to partner with this veteran and this veteran is going to spend the whole time telling you that your ideas are unconventional and wrong. He's really kind of been given the reins to run with it now. And that's why this season is even more completely insane.
So is that something you've noticed more over the years, Raul, that this idea that Canadian talent is getting just more ability to just be themselves, and you know, Canada gets to be Canada, and Toronto gets to be Toronto, and you know, the actors are who they are and who they represent, rather than trying to be someone else or some other country or some other culture. Is that a fair statement, or is that still a an uphill struggle.
Well, production in Canada is really divided into the camp of international programming and Canadian programming. So Canadian programming domestically has almost always, particularly if it's come from the CBC, by necessity, it's been set in Canada with Canadian characters talking about Canadian things. There has been, I think, you know, to get historical for the listeners, Flashpoint, if you remember that procedural cop show about a Toronto SWAT team.
Mm-hmm, no,
Flashpoint was one of the first international shows that had Toronto as Toronto. It was on American television. It was on Canadian television. It was sold all over the world. That was kind of a groundbreaker for a domestic Canadian commercial show that didn't sort of try to set it in a nondescript North American city.
No, sure. What year was that?
I would say that was around, I did a couple episodes of that. I want to say that was around 2008, 9, 10.
Okay.
10,
okay.
11.
Yeah.
You know, so Flashpoint was an important sort of flag in the soil, at least for me, as far as I see. So yeah. After that, you know, shows like Orphan Black and a couple other, like, they kind of let Toronto be Toronto a little bit more. And in some shows, even more explicitly, Canada be Canada, that were intended for the international market. You know, and but American shows and international shows, you know, yeah, we're always standing in for places that aren't here often mm-hmm. or usually. But the exciting change, I think, even though in many ways Canadian programming is kind of under threat, because as the streamers have moved into the marketplace, a lot of the domestic broadcasters have said, well, fudge it. If these guys aren't going to commit to making Canadian shows, we're not going to do it either and make us. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the thing we're dealing with some, you know, the digital services, streaming taxes and
yeah,
all these
sure,
things,
yeah.
Which, of course, the Americans would like to now remove from our taxation system, which is basically on the streamers to say, we're going to tax the digital streamers so we can put money towards Canadian content. That's on the top of President Trump's agenda to get rid of those all around the world. Like, they're talking about getting rid of it in the UK so they don't get tariffed.
Right,
and we've just
right.
had it pass in Canada 6 months ago. So it's not really even been that used or tested here. But, you know, it was also a bill being used to try to support domestic news and local news,
yeah.
Which the streamers don't really have much to do with. So the downside is we've lost some Canadian programming because the domestic broadcasters have backed off their commitment, feeling it's unfair. But when what the flip side of the streamers is that they have provided for the odd Canadian show an international platform. Like, the lives of the actors on Kim's Convenience transformed once it went to Netflix International.
Sure, yeah.
You know, like, that's how Paul Sung-Yeon Lee became that helped get him onto Star Wars. That helped Simu Liu become a Marvel movie star.
Right.
It's that, you know, these, you know, in the beginning of my career, a Canadian show made for the CBC very rarely was seen anywhere else in the world, and definitely not in America or likely in England.
Yeah.
They were seen in Hungary, dubbed, and in different markets of the world, they were dubbed. You know, the odd time my father-in-law used to live in Norway, the odd time some episode of some show I'd be on would pop up, you know, at midnight in Norway on TV, and you go, oh, cool. But, you know, having a show like Working Moms, Kim's Convenience, some of these other shows go international on the streamers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's given profile to Canadian shows that are very Canadian. Another one that's not yet international, but, you know, Son of a Critch, the most Newfoundland type show you could ever have. You know, that was on the CW in the States. You know, I'd be in Los Angeles and see like ads for, you know, the show about a kid whose dad runs the local radio station in St. John's, Newfoundland in 1985. That would be on like at dinner time in Los Angeles. And I'd be going, wow, what the hell is going on? This is crazy. So sort of, you know, it's a double-edged sword. In some ways, we have lost some domestic Canadian programming. But in another way, there's now an opportunity for Canadian programming to go more international. And I think the marketplace is looking for these things that are a little bit different. I mean, Kim's Convenience was a very unique show. And I think that helped it, you know, get appeal around the world. So,
yeah.
You know, these shows like Shorzy, Letterkenny, like, they are very unique, super Canadian oddities that have built cult followings, like in a previous time, the Trailer Park Boys did, you know, to draw a full circle to that. You know, the Trailer Park Boys was a cult hit. And I know people all around the world who know that show. Of course, there's tons of people who don't too, because it wasn't like mainstream, but it has a global niche audience. And that's kind of more what television is now anyways, unless you're on the, I mean, look, you can be the biggest show on Netflix like, say, Adolescence right now, but they're the biggest show on Netflix until everybody who has a Netflix subscription's watched it. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, there's another giant show. So yeah, even then, so you know, it's very hard to have something that's sustained. It's more that, you know, they get shows get the spotlight for a couple of weeks and then they're gone.
Yeah, that's true, eh? There's an awful lot of content that's out there. Going away from the television thing a little bit, just to your Hamlet solo. This is something that you've now been doing for, am I right in saying it's about 20 years at least?
Yeah, I think it's about 19 years now. Since we opened it, but I started working on it 25 years ago, for sure. Yeah.
This is amazing. And this is such a contrast to you being part of an ensemble in a film or
yeah, really,
or television.
I actually hate working with other people.
That's what it came down to.
I only rely and trust myself. So everything I said was a lie.
Well, going back to 25 years when you first started, and I know you come from a theater background, having gone to National Theater School in Montreal and having trained in theater, but whatever made you want to, you know, tackle a play like Hamlet and basically do, how many characters altogether are you doing in it?
I kind of lose track. The great comedian Eddie Izzard is now touring the world with a solo Hamlet, and I think she says 36 characters. I think I say 17 or 18, but...
No, you worked with Eddie Izzard on a show a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we were, funny little showbiz story. We were, I had a gun to Eddie Izzard's head in the back of a minivan at the Canadian National Exhibition site where there was a lot of shooting during COVID. And we were just in the back of this van where I take the character Eddie was playing hostage. And we're sitting in the back of this van for hours and hours and hours and hours. And we just start talking because it's literally the two of us. And about halfway through the afternoon, you know, and Eddie's an incredible person with a genius kind of, you know, a real unicorn of a human being.
Nice.
This stand-up and actor. I mean, Eddie does, who also now goes by Susie, so I'm going to switch to Susie Izzard because that's how she prefers to be named. Susie is someone who, for example, does her stand-up in three different languages. And I said, how do you do? And I was like, how do you do, when did you learn German to be able to do your routine in German? And she says, well, actually, I don't speak German. And I was like, okay, hold on. So you don't speak German, but you do your routine in German. And she's like, yeah, well, I speak a little bit of it, but no, I learned it phonetically.
Oh my goodness.
So you're kind of like, so for this person to then say to me in the back of the van, she says, yeah, you know, well, as a trans woman, no one's ever going to let me play Hamlet. So I'm just going to do it on my own. And I said, what, a solo Hamlet? She said, yeah, I'm working on it right now. And I said, okay, well, you're not going to know this because, of course, I'm just some Canadian actor who'd know the fuck who I am. But I was like, you're not going to know this, but I've actually been doing a solo Hamlet for like 15 years. And she was like, oh, cool. So you've already done it. So cut to a couple years later, I go down to New York with my director, Robert, who lives in New York. And we got to see Eddie's solo Hamlet, which was so wild because I've pretty much never met anyone who does this. And Eddie does it and does it completely. I mean, in some ways, it's the same. It's one person on stage doing Hamlet, but it's like a complete, it's, you know, it's two totally different actors with two totally different concepts.
Right.
So it was pretty wild to see someone else take a run at it. But yeah, I had been exposed to the play, Mark, by our English teacher, who we probably had at the same time in our high school, Jane Moore, who taught, you know, OAC grade 13 Hamlet as part of her English.
This is going back a bit.
Yeah, going back to the early 90s.
Yeah, of course.
And I fell in love with the play, of course, in her class. She's so passionate, such an amazing English teacher, and also someone who loved theater. So, you know, we watched the BBC Derek Jacobi Hamlet on VHS, and the class was going through it so slowly, it was driving me nuts. I begged her one day after class, can I take the VHS home and finish this thing? Because it's driving me nuts. I want to know how it ends. And also, you know, and of course, at the same time, Hamlet is a play that so many actors over the years have used as a measuring stick to, you know, that great sort of with Nail and I joke about, you know, playing the Dane. I shall never play the Dane. So in another way, it's sort of this cliche of actordom that, you know, can you play Hamlet? There's the famous story of even the great Daniel Day-Lewis getting so into it that while he was performing it in England in the ghost scene, he thought he saw the ghost of his actual dead father, walked off the stage and never performed again on stage.
I actually just saw that clip quite recently where he talked about
it's kicking around on Instagram, right? I was reminded of that. And so So fortunately, I've never had that happen to me. I'm too busy trying not to forget my lines because I'm one person doing the whole play. But it was a play I was always drawn to. It's this kind of measuring stick for actors. Once we'd gone through the process of learning it and premiering it and then touring it, you know, it's been a real joy, pleasure, and challenge. Now I'm 50, right? I premiered it when I was 31. Now being a 50-year-old actor trying to do the same show, in some ways it's different and in some ways it's gotten better because, you know, very rarely as an actor outside of the European, and by that I mean continental European repertory system, it's very rare that an actor gets to go back to the same roles or the same play in their career. You know, we're much more disposable here. We don't have this thing of like, you know, the Arts Club in Vancouver's memorial production of Threepenny Opera that we've done for 35 years with the same, some of the same actors are in it. Like, that's the European tradition.
Yeah,
but we don't have that here. So yeah. I'm in a very rare, lucky territory to get to go back to work on Hamlet over and over again. And it's basically this like giant onion where the layers just keep peeling back and it's always revealing itself. And, you know, it's such a masterwork. You never feel like you're, you know, running it or doing it.
What are some of those differences, Raoul, between when you were doing as a young man and you thought, you know, I don't care, I'm just going to do this project on my own, I'm going to take it on as a solo project, and then now approaching it, you know, many years later as an actor, like what are some of the key differences there for you?
Well, you know, I think it was always kind of a bit of an old man's work. I remember I had this wonderful acting teacher, Peter Wilde, who was a big influence on me, who just passed away a couple years ago in his 90s. And he had been Rosencrantz opposite Peter O'Toole in Hamlet at the Bristol Old Vic. So this guy had around. And he came to see my Hamlet solo in 2006. And he said, oh, yeah, this reminds me of when Michael Redgrave did it when he was almost 50. You know, it's like a considered sort of retelling. And, you know, and I remember thinking at that time, like, man, I'm 30. What are you talking about? Some 50-year-old guy version of it. But I realized kind of what he meant is that it was sort of a pretty unique take on it, because doing it as a solo piece as well, you know, in some ways you're right in the middle of it. And in another way, you're quite detached because the whole time you're switching from character to character. So it's very hard for me to have a see the ghost of my dead father transformative moment on stage, because I'm almost not allowed technically to get that lost in it, because then I'm switching over to the next guy. But I suppose the pleasure of it is that when we first did the play, we were really trying to prove our concept to the world. We were trying to prove ourselves as younger actors and a younger director that we kind of belonged, and that, you know, I guess in some ways I was also making a statement about how this was the way I was going to have access to Hamlet, because, you know, this 31-year-old half-Indian, half-Irish guy, even though I had gone to the National Theater School, I was unlikely to be one of the chosen two that get to do it at Stratford in a decade. And I didn't really see a place for myself. So this was kind of my way to do it my way. What's great is that as the years have gone on, I really don't have any interest in playing Hamlet in a production, because I've realized that this version I do is kind of my contribution to the theater, because not many people can do this or do it the way I do it. But I think the real gift of it has been I took quite a long break. So saying I've done it for 19 years, there was almost an 8-year period where I didn't do it anymore because I was doing other shows. But during the pandemic, Robert and I, my director, we decided to bring it back to a solo festival in New York. And we wanted to see if I could still do it. And if there was any value in us still doing it. And once we did the performance there, it was just one night, a bunch of friends from New York and the theater and TV and movies that came. And, you know, it was maybe 40 people watching. And, you know, we did it that night and said, yeah, you know what? We should still keep doing this. We have something to offer, and I could still get through it without being a complete physical mess. And then it just happened like a couple of weeks later to win Best Actor at that festival. And then we're like, oh, okay, well, cool. Now we've got like something to talk about that's not like, hey, this show got a great review in Calgary in 2011. You know, we could talk about something much more current. And then we, you know, again, it's only been a few engagements here and there, but we've started to kind of ramp it back up and bring it back. But the real pleasure of getting back to it now is that, of course, you're bringing like a whole other level of skill and experience, but also life experience to it. And in some ways now, you know, we don't care about impressing anybody because we're old. And I've done enough stuff. And, you know, it's not some show that's ever going to make me super famous or rich. And gosh, now I'm competing against a version done by Eddie Izzard that she can do all over the world. And I still can't probably do it in most of the places that would sign her up immediately. I mean, she's a famous comedian, too. So nothing wrong with that. But so I'm really doing it because I want to, because I believe in it. And also, we've just developed this relationship with it where I think it's gone deeper and deeper. You know, around 2007, I did it in England at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in the Gielgud Studio for the student actors, which was a really cool opportunity, you know, to be a Canadian doing it like at the birthplace of the British actor. And at the end of it, a friend of mine who I'd met on the road touring it, Tess, she's a voice coach. She was actually the voice coach for the Royal Shakespeare Company. She was helping John Lithgow when he was doing Twelfth Night. We were staying in the same bed and breakfast of all things, and we kind of hit it off. So she was nice enough to come and watch that performance at RADA. And she came up to me afterwards when we walked back to my hotel, and she said, "No, this is really good. It's really great. But, you know, I have this feeling about your show." And I was like, "Please tell me, you know, like this is a very experienced person who's worked on Shakespeare." She said, "Right now when you're performing the show, it's like you're in the attic. And as you keep working on this show, you have to go, imagine you're in the attic and as you keep working on the show, you need to smash through each floor to go deeper and deeper and try to get into the basement." And it was such an evocative image. Of course, there was that little part of me that was defensive going, "What do you mean I'm not in the basement? What do you mean it's not?" You know, as you do as an actor.
Well, sure.
But that has been such an amazing thing to think. She told me that in 2008, and I'm still in touch with her these days. And that's a journey that continues where I'm still trying to go sort of deeper with it and have it sit. And so I do think it's become much richer because, like any kind of classical artist, I suppose, you know, I have a deeper relationship to my life, to the world, to the material, to my own instrument. So I think that's really how it's changed. And I think I'm better at it. And I think I'm more able to live in the moment. Like before, I felt like I had to kind of show the audience what it was. And now my goal is to be alive in the moment with the audience every second I can. And let it just take me wherever it takes me. So the cool thing is, even after all this time and 150 performances, and I've done it in 20 different theaters all over the place, it's still kind of different every time I do it, which all good theater should be. But it really just takes me on its own little journey. So that's why I still love doing it. It's still terrifying, and I'm still nervous. I'm never, like, it's the most demanding thing I've ever done and probably ever will do. So I'm still petrified by it, but it's a good challenge. And again, I feel like it's my own little contribution to the giant Hamlet mountain out there.
It's a huge contribution. It really is. But as you're saying, you touched on something there about being in the moment, which I assume, you know, never having done any theater, but theater, any sort of acting or any music, being in the moment is obviously always the sort of goal for any performer, to actually sort of be able to experience what you're doing right there without any sort of distraction in your mind or any other sort of, you know, external factors.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a battle, right? But I think, you know, I think of it, and Mark, you'd understand this too. It's like the part of me as a musician that improvises. You know, when you're in a great space, when you're improvising, you are free, right? You're letting it guide you instead of you guide it. You know, I had a teacher, again, you'll have to beat me out if I'm not supposed to use this language, but again, a lesson like the one Tess told me. I had another one when I was at the National Theatre School. There was a legendary teacher at Stratford by the name of Michael Mawson, who's long passed away. And he had this reputation of being kind of a hard ass, but also a genius. And he came to our school and we were to do one-on-one monologues for him before we went to go do this kind of career showcase. So everyone was very nervous. This legendary teacher was coming. And so I had a monologue from the Revengers tragedy, this Jacobean drama. You know, I was going in there and I was like, "Man, I'm going to impress this guy. You know, like he's going to walk out there and he's going to call up the artistic director of Stratford and I'm going to get offered Romeo next year. Like I'm going to go in there and like knock this guy's socks off." So I go in and I try really hard and I do my thing. And he's sort of standing there at the end of my piece and he goes, yeah, it's not bad. But you know what you need to do?" And of course I'm hanging on his every word. And he says, "Let it fuck you. don't fuck it. And I just was like, you know, and I was like, again, I was the young actor who was like, well, what the hell is that supposed to mean? And why is he being so crass? And I mean, I'm just trying to be a genius actor here. But when I think about it, it's like when it, particularly when it comes to Hamlet solo and the classical acting, and in some ways, if you think of it as a musician and improvisation, you know, and I never had another lesson with him again. I spoke to him a couple more times in my entire life. But that one thing he said to me, I think, is so applicable to performance, in that you're trying to get to a place of preparation where you're letting the material guide you and you're getting out of the way of it instead of trying to manage it and steer it. And that's always a struggle for the actor. I still have that struggle all the time. But when I'm in kind of the right spot, when it's really singing, when it's really working, I'm both technically totally in control of what I'm doing, and at the same time, I'm completely free inside it to let it take me to new places.
Do you find it easier to get to that place on stage or on set? Yeah, which one do you find that
That's a good question. I mean, on set, you're working in very small pieces, but ultimately you're still trying to do the same thing. You're still trying to like execute the scene, but be alive in it, that if your partner, you know, throws you something different, you're able to respond. Like, I have a show I'm currently working on that I can't tell you what it is. I'm working with a very accomplished Academy Award winning actor.
Wow.
And this Academy Award winning actor, in my coverage, so that means when the camera is on me and not on them, this actor is 100% committed to their acting.
Oh, nice.
And it's a great reminder because of how important it is for that actor who's not on camera to be giving their scene partner as much as when the camera's on them. And this actor's called me out on it a few times and said to me when we were in a scene together, like, come on, give it to me. Like, the camera's not on you, but don't give up. Like, I need you to be there for me in the same way.
Sure.
And not every actor is, but it's a reminder that someone even at that level, when it comes to the nitty gritty of the day grind of every scene, every take, is putting that much focus and energy into it to allow the other person that perhaps infinitesimal moment, that fleeting moment of having that free feeling inside it where something magical happens. So that's what we're always aspiring to. I don't know how often it actually happens or not, but that's kind of when, that's the whole point of being an actor or a performer, live performer, is to try to get into that state where it just happens.
Do you find that you have times where there's crossover when you're on stage with your band, Raoul in the Big Time, and you know, you've got that same feeling, and then next time you're, you know, on stage as Hamlet, and you have, is there ever like a dissonance in terms of those moments where, am I a musician? Am I an actor? And I'm communicating with the audience.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, being someone who has, for as long as he's been an actor, also actively been a musician, I'm asked the question all the time, like, what is it like to do both? Which one do you like more? Which one are you better at? And I guess for me, I get slightly different things out of them, but I identify myself much more. When people ask me what I do, or if I ever have to write it down, I always say I'm a performer. I never really, and if I have to break it down, I say, yeah, I'm an actor, I'm a musician, I'm a writer, I'm a producer. Like, I do all the, actually, I usually go actor, musician, producer, writer, if I have to break it down. That's kind of the order for me, because I create a lot of my own work and opportunities. The difference between singing a blues song and doing a soliloquy is not that different. And that's just how I'm kind of wired. And while, of course, they come out off in a different way, and they're often in different settings, I don't try either of them out in either setting very often. It's just kind of the same thing for me. You're trying to tell a story. You're trying to connect with an audience. You're trying to find a kind of truth and honesty and connection to it that means something to people. You know, that's what Shakespeare would have wanted you to do. And that's what Muddy Waters did, I think, almost every time he opened his mouth. So to me, it's all kind of the same thing. Of course, the mediums are different, like TV's different, like movies different, like playing on a festival stage for 10,000 people or playing for the more frequent 17 people in a nightclub. You're still trying to do the same thing, which is like move people with art, you know, one way or the other. And it's more that the medium is what shifts, not really my intention or my goal.
Why the genre of blues? Because it's interesting, as you're saying here, Raoul, you know, we're talking about high art, Hamlet, theater. And then we're talking about blues, which is, I don't know, I mean, it's not classical music, obviously. And it's, you know, it's a music I love just as much as you do. But what drew you to both of those things? What drew you to acting at the very beginning? What drew you to wanting to be a blues musician more so than any other genre musician?
Well, I mean, let's not forget that while blues is a folk art that I think is gaining a kind of importance like one of the classical musics, as time goes on, I think it'll find it, it'll be blues performed in its sort of origin form will almost be a kind of classical music that very few people can actually do. You know, like 100 years from now, watch, like, can someone actually do a, you know, a competitive, accurate, deeply felt Robert Johnson or Blind Willie McTell number? I mean, imagine the skills that someone's going to need 100 years from now to be able to do a Blind Willie McTell 1928 recording.
It's or, the right emotion.
Yeah, yeah. And to have a connection to it and understand where it came from and to try to inhabit it honestly. So I actually think blues is going to move more into a classical kind of format, or a part of it will, the early blues will.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, you know, we forget that Shakespeare started much more like a commercial folk art than it was. It was never anything classical at its time. It was a complete populist, cash-driven, daily, weekly entertainment. It was never intended for academic study or this kind of historical preservation society stuff at all. So again, I kind of think in terms of their origins, they're both the same thing. For me, you know, I was always interested in being in front of people. I was always interested. I was always doing accents and funny voices as a kid. I used to always try to do something at Christmas time at our house. We'd have sort of little family performances or concerts and little goofy things we'd do for each other. I was always trying to get people's attention. I'm the younger of two, right? So I was the younger kid. So I was always trying to get people's attention, you know, because I had an older brother who got attention. And then, you know, in high school, I started doing Shakespeare on the street with a group in Ottawa that I think is celebrating its 35th anniversary this season. Yeah. Company
great.
Of Fools, you know, which I started.
Right,
and
yeah.
And I was one of the founding members of, and Company of Fools, we would go around the streets of Ottawa on the weekends and at lunchtime and literally busk doing scenes from Shakespeare. I did that for 2 summers. And so for me, my connection to Shakespeare was actually not that different when I got a chance to work at Shakespeare's Globe in London in 2002, when the great Mark Rylance was still artistic director. When I was there at the Globe, I was like, yeah, this, you know, it's kind of revolutionary when they built Shakespeare's Globe, rebuilt it in the late mid-90s, because it created this sort of version of kind of what Shakespeare's theater would have been like, you know, partially outdoors, audience standing, no stage lighting, so it's all happening under natural light. Those were all things that to me were how you do Shakespeare anyways, because I was doing it by the Terry Fox statue or on Spark Street as a teenager.
Sure, yeah.
And right at the same time is when I you know, as a kid living in Germany, actually, I had my geography teacher and her husband lived across the street from us. And he was this guy who was a multi-instrumentalist, but kind of, you know, master of none. You know, he played them all sort of okay, but he was not a professional musician. He was like an ex-British Army paratrooper or something like that. Like he was just a hobbyist. But one day I had seen a harmonica on his shelf in his house, and he said, "Oh, do you want it?" And I took it, and it was he made the crucial error of buying a harmonica in E, thinking that that was going to be a great blues key. But of course, a diatonic harmonica in E is incredibly high. But
yeah.
What I learned years later is that I had that black Hohner Pro Harp in the key of E for years, and that's what I taught myself on. But I ran into a harmonica player once who'd been mentored by James Cotton. And as
oh, wow.
a kid, James Cotton has told him, play in a high key because it's easier. The reeds are shorter. You don't need as much air. So thank God I got this funny high-keyed harmonica, because I would walk to school and walk back from school, and I just started playing it all the time. And then after a while, I went to a record shop in Bonn, Germany, where I grew up, and said,
yeah.
Hey, where can I get – I play harmonica. Where can I listen to blues that has harmonica in it? Because the only blues I'd heard before that was basically any blues that Jimi Hendrix had done. I'd never heard any other kind of blues. And, you know, typical record store experience of people of our generation, you know, some hippie dude leaned back and said – here's, you know, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee on the road again. Yeah. That guy plays harmonica. And then, you know, wasn't that much after that. I got Sonny Boy Williamson folk blues. And I got, you know, James, the one that really changed my mind and brain was James Cotton Live at Antone's. You know, once I got those records, sure. I was on my way.
So you mentioned something, you know, that whole idea of walking to a record shop back in the day and just sort of getting an education, you know, on the spot with someone who just was, you know, crazy about whatever was going on at that time in music. What about you in terms of teaching some of this stuff? Like, are you interested in mentoring, or would you like to do workshops, or do you do workshops?
You know, technically, I'm not a very good harmonica player. I've been playing for a long time and I can get by, but I was never a great student of the harmonica in terms of instruction. I mean, God, I've had little workshops with Carlos Del Junco and Jason Ricci, and really my biggest mentors in harmonica were Johnny Sansone out of New Orleans, who used to come to Ottawa when we were teenagers. Mark, you remember?
Mm-hmm. And then, no, I remember him. Yeah.
And then Mark Hummel, who's been a great mentor to me. Technically, I'm not very good at explaining what I do. And the whole world of harmonica instruction, particularly with YouTube and Dave Barrett's Harmonica Masterclass, and, you know, like, there's amazing people who can teach it. So I'm not really the guy for that. But I do enjoy mentorship, and whether it's been in acting or in music, you know, more and more in the last couple years, you know, people have reached out or asked for advice. And, you know, I'm happy to share advice, but I haven't really focused too much on teaching. You know, in acting, I had amazing acting teachers in my formative years who were very much devoted to the craft of teaching. And I sort of feel at this point in my life like I'm still so actively trying to perform. I don't really feel like I have the pedagogical experience or focus to really go off and teach somebody for 6 months or whatever, or go teach a class at the National Theatre School. I'm much better at let's have a career talk or let's have an art talk for 2 hours in class than I am to be like, here's your guide to incredible harmonica blues playing, or here's my intro to acting course. I just have never really put in the time.
But it seems to me that's the part that's really valuable. Like, you know, YouTube is full of videos that will teach you the technique of so many things. But having those conversations where someone just imparts, you know, a little bit of wisdom, or just they notice something about what you're doing, that's still pretty rare, I think. And so anybody who's able to pass on those conversations about, you know, what's it like, to me seems way more valuable than just a technical piece of progression.
I guess so.
Or
I mean,
like,
you know, you got to put in the time though, right? So like a great technical instructor can really, you know, make someone's technique better, and you need technique in
Absolutely.
Any of this stuff. So,
Absolutely.
I mean, but I guess it also comes a bit from the tradition, you know, Mark and I grew up in as musicians, you know, pre-YouTube. I mean, there was the odd instructional video, but basically you had to listen with your ears, or you had to have somebody to give you a hint or a trick. And blues is completely, it's both an oral and an oral tradition of how information and teachings and experience was passed down, either through somebody telling you or you listening. So that kind of sharing of the tradition or sharing of information, that's more what I know how to do and how I feel comfortable, because, you know, there was no Royal Conservatory of Music blues harmonica instruction thing to do, or you didn't get into the Kiwanis Music Festival with your 8 different kids get up and try to do Little Walter's Blue Midnight and we picked the best kid. Like, that didn't exist, right? Thankfully. So I think it's from that tradition too, you know, that, I mean, how did we learn anything? We'd go nerd out on some harmonica player, guitar player, or singer who would come through town. We'd corner them and be like, "Hey man, I love what you do. What was it like on this recording, or what amp did you use, or who are your big influences?" Like, that's how we learned. And I kind of think for a young person, for all the great information that's there on YouTube for all kinds of things, or on Instagram Reels or whatever, you know, it's still that one-on-one connection with the fellow artist where you can really learn. I mean, look, the two of the biggest lessons I've had in my life were from almost one-time interactions with artists who told me one thing to do. So, you know, like, I'm always kind of trying to, I still do that. I still have a lot of mentors and people I look to who are older than me. I mean, I'm 50. I'm always looking to the people above me and who came before to share their ideas and wisdom with me. I by no means feel like I figured it all out. Hell no.
No, sure, I know. Well, that's the wonderful thing about being in the arts. It never ends as far as how much you can learn about your craft. It really is.
And you endless. I think you only really know that you are getting any wiser with it when you realize how little you know and how hard it is to actually clinically execute it.
Yes.
There's so much more kind of random, you know, the creativity is such a, I mean, there's no mistake. They called it a muse, you know, you know, Shakespeare needed to be visited by his muse because he had writer's block. Like if it was like a math equation, everybody could do it. The reality is hardly any, but when you think of like all the people in the world, when it comes to like what I guess at least in our culture we call, you know, professional or semi-professional artistic performance, barely anybody does it for a few reasons, but also barely anybody can do it because it requires such a strange collection of both desire, impulse, and talent. It's so weird. So, you know, a lot of the time, I think in this age we're in, it's kind of been devalued because of the sort of plethora of digital offerings. But when it comes down to the actual doing of it, you know, it's still a pretty rare thing to do.
That's something I always admired about you, Raul, is that you made that choice many years ago to say, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be a performer. And, you know, for hell or high water, you've pursued it all the way through these years, which is, I think, so admirable, you know, because there's going to be highs and there's going to be lows, as we all know. Was there ever a moment where you thought, hang on a minute, you know, should I go back to school for something else? Or did you ever waver in your decisions?
Well,
right now, doing this interview, you're like, you know, maybe.
Yeah, I just led me to this. I hate podcasts. I've realized I hate podcasts. No, it's so interesting because, you know, I never really contemplated it until COVID when I thought, what if we can't, like, I didn't think it was likely, but, you know, in the earliest days of COVID, what if we can't gather inside to do live performance ever again?
God, yeah.
And I thought, what else could I do? Would I do? How would I feed my kids? How would I, like, nourish my own creativity? What will be left for us? So it was existential, but also thankfully very theoretical. And, you know, at that time I started to think about other kinds of things, but it was never, I can honestly say it's never been by choice. It was never something where, and really because I have had, I make my living, particularly now, much more as an actor who plays music on the side. But of course, when I started, it was more of a 50-50 split because for a musician at my level, there was more opportunity to just make a basic living playing in nightclubs and selling CDs off the stage than there is now. But because I always had this outlet as a musician, and really I started Raul in the Big Time back in 1998 because I needed an outlet as a creative person and a live performer that I wasn't getting as an actor who was, you know, just emerging on the scene, who was sitting at home and waiting for the agent to call and my phone to ring. And if I did get something, it would be a one-line part playing a gangster in some TV show. And I was supposed to go home and be like, oh yeah, that was the equivalent of playing Hamlet. And you're like, no, it's not. You're like a nameless actor that no one gives a shit about. And you say your one line and people go, thanks, bye, next scene. Yeah. So I needed to have something creative in my life that was more fulfilling and that I basically had more control over. And in a funny way, having the band and having live music and now the jazz thing I do, like having that in my life, while sometimes it gets very complicated with my schedule or now, and as I say now, it's so hard to play live music and really make any money and you're barely able to fairly pay your adult grown-up musicians anymore. But having that gave me something when I look back now that I think allowed me to survive some of those periods where I felt really at sea and where my career wasn't going how I wanted it to go, or the business itself stopped. Like I look at all, you know, we've maybe got American tariffs now. We've had SARS, we've had COVID, we've had 9/11, we've had the 2008 financial crisis. We had the tech bubble bursting. You know, all these things have happened, which have made this weird TV and film industry kind of grind to a halt. And then everyone goes, oh my God, it's over. It's going to disappear. But it finds its way back. So through all those, I've had live performance mainly as a musician, but then also as my career went on, I produced and self-produced more of live theater like Hamlet Solo. And those gave me little things that gave me more control. They wouldn't necessarily pay me a lot of money, but I wasn't completely captive. And look, the other thing I have to say is that, you know, I bought my house, sorry, still paying for it, but I was able to start to buy my house 20 years ago when a house was not $1 million, which almost no artist who's emerging could ever even imagine doing.
No, that's so true.
And so like I had that Gen X window where I was just able to afford to begin to pay for my house with my earnings as an artist, you know, and that's totally disappeared now. So I was quite lucky to have been in that position compared to young people now who are trying to get in. That, you know, having a house that I own has gave me a financial backstop that allowed me to stay in the arts more than if I didn't own a home.
As you said, it is, and it is a compulsion, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's not just something you're going to go, well, I just chose it because I wanted to do it. No, you need to do it.
It's kind of a vocation. You know, I definitely feel like that when I'm in the Arctic in a motel doing Hamlet Solo on my own with no one else around me who I've ever met or known. You know, there is a little part of you waiting 8 hours till showtime where you do kind of think like, yeah, this is a bit like, I got to be really into this. Yeah, like it is sometimes, particularly when I'm out touring Hamlet solo and I'm on my own when my director isn't with me or I don't have a stage manager, you know, it feels very monastic sometimes. You're like, oh no, this, I'm on this sort of, I have this vocation. And you know what it's like, oh my God, as a blues musician, Christ, we're playing some weird places for hardly anybody, making hardly any money. And you're going like, you know, and grownups look at you and go like, why are you doing this, man? Like, why are you doing it? And you're like, no, it's my calling. It's what I have to do. It's what makes me happy. And for my whole, just to sort of answer a bit of a previous question, I have at times tried to be more maybe focused on being an actor or a musician, or my schedule has just made it that way. And I can't live without either of them. I have to do both of them. I've learned that a long time ago. I can't kind of turn one spigot entirely off and the other one to full bore. I just can't do it. I have to do both things to be happy, and I can't really explain it. But also, nobody's stopping me. I mean, nobody really cares. I mean, do whatever the, you know, it's not like, oh my God, my schedules are so conflicting that I'll never be able. No, I mean, yeah, I suppose if I was as big as Lady Gaga, I'd have to make a choice. World tour or Oscar nominated performance? Which one? But
the answer is both.
I think, as you're saying, it was a matter of control as well.
Yes.
You know, the music you have control over, you know, Hamlet solo you have control over.
No, and you're right. And with music, because also I'm more idiot than savant when it comes to music, like I only play the music I want to play. As an actor, I'm trained and my job is to do whatever anybody else asks me to do. As long as I don't have a financial or moral objection, I'll do it.
Sure. Yeah.
But with music, it's like, I don't know music well enough to be able to like go play in 20 other people's bands. Christ, I'm a harmonica player. Nobody wants a harmonica player. And I'm a singer who sings my own thing. And I'm like, I'm an okay singer, but I'm not like, you know, I can't sing like Luther Vandross. So, you know, it's sort of, you know, music really is my own creative and artistic domain. And in acting, I'm much more qualified and the expectation is much more that I'm there to interpret other people's stuff and just do whatever I'm asked to do. So that's also probably why it's become more the thing I earn money at. But of course, that's also happened because it's gotten so hard to make any music as a musician, any money as a musician.
Unfortunately, it seems to be the case, isn't it? Yeah. One of the last things I want to touch on is our mutual friend, James Super Chicken Johnson, because after we did this film and when we toured it, it always came up. There was always a question from an audience member of like, how did you meet Mr. Super Chicken? And I always came back to saying, well, it's a really good friend of mine, Raul Beneja, out of Toronto, brought him to Toronto, did some shows with him. And he suggested we do the same thing in Vancouver. And then you also suggested, hey, you want to make a documentary film sometime? You should
I just need 10%. I just need 10% of all future royalties.
Yes. Yes, it's
thank you. We've now got it on recording, ladies and gentlemen. I require 10% payment of all future revenue from the James Super Chicken Johnson documentary. No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
No, but it's true. I mean, that was something that you, I think that's just tying us all together. I mean, this, you, as Brian had asked you about mentoring and being a teacher, it's not something you do at an institution, but you certainly have that reputation as, and you've helped me as well, is mentoring people and giving them advice when it comes to performing arts, which I think is a great thing. And you know, your advice as far as Super Chicken was concerned certainly was a wonderful piece of advice, because it really did.
Well, and now you guys have made, I mean, I could never even imagine doing what you guys have done. You know, Super Chicken is someone I you know, what he represents, who he is, his music, what he means to me. You know, you guys have created such a loving tribute to the man. And the world has an ability to hear his story and to try to understand what it is to actually be a modern day Mississippi musician, which not many people have done since the great documentary Deep Blues. You know, so you guys are right in there as a contributing to the whole world having, if they want to learn more about this amazing guy. I mean, the part, you know, the part of me that's a producer loves to do what happened with you and Super Chicken. And it doesn't require a 10% of royalty at all. It's putting together. I love putting together, either for my own benefit or other people's benefit, I love putting people together who I know with the hope that it might make something cool. I'm just in the middle of helping a friend who has an amazing theater property that she creates with a giant commercial producer who I've worked with.
Great.
And I don't really have much to gain from it, and it's probably might not even have my name anywhere on it. But it's that opportunity where I see, I know a lot of people between acting and music and social media. Like in my life, I have met an enormous amount of people. Yeah. And there are these occasions where I've been able to connect people and put people together. And it's brought about with luck and good fortune. And I think to some degree, my eye, it's brought together something amazing. So you playing with Super Chicken and your burgeoning filmmaking career at that time, I mean, now it's turned out to create this thing, which is more than I could ever imagine could happen from that union. And you have a film that's going all around the world, and James is going to be seen by all these other people who've never seen him before, and his story is shared with the world. Like I shared his story a little bit in the play that I toured called Life, Death, and the Blues, right? So yes. I had a little story about him, and I played one of his instruments in my show. And now you're able to then take it to this other level. And so I met Super Chicken. Here's just a quick funny story for you. So how do I meet Super Chicken before you meet Super Chicken? Well, I decide I'm going to make this play about my life in the blues, and how does this half Indian, half Irish kid, as you say, fall in love with black music? Like, where does that come from? And then basically it'd be the music of his life. And not only the music he enjoys as a fan, but a music that he decides touches his soul so much that he has to then perform it and share it with people like it's his own. Doesn't make any sense on one level, right? And my director and longtime friend, Ida Holmes, who's now the artistic director of the Centaur Theater in Montreal, when I was developing the play with her, she said, well, we got to go to Mississippi. You've been to Mississippi before, right? And I sheepishly said, well, actually, no. She's like, what? And she said, well, we got to go to Clarksdale. And I got my friend Panny down there, who is a photographer, but she's also definitely deeply involved in the blues, but she's also someone who helps with the Tennessee Williams Festival in Clarksdale. Because, of course, Tennessee Williams was from Clarksdale. A lot of his characters have been inspired by his life there.
That's right, yeah.
And she, Ida, had been to Clarksdale previously to bring a scene from Canada from her Shaw Festival production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which in Clarksdale featured one of my best friends and National Theater School classmate Severn Thompson, who's also my neighbor. She's been to Clarksdale. So they came back and they were like, oh, hell, man, you got to go to Clarksdale. And that's when I was like, well, you know who lives in Clarksdale is Super Chicken, who's this completely unique, you know, folk artist, blues musician character. And so we go down and we meet Panny, and she says, yo, you want to go meet Chicken? And I was like, yeah, let's go. And I go to his workshop like you guys did, and she introduced me and I met him, and that's the, and then I bought one of his instruments and I interviewed him and I learned about his story, and then he ends up, his story and his instrument ends up in my play, and then I bring him up and he starts playing with us in Toronto. He plays with us at the Pan Am Games. We do Kerner Hall together. We play some festivals together, some other shows. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to have him up here since COVID, but then you pick up the torch. You bring him to Vancouver. You start, and then you guys go to Clarksdale a ton of times, and you guys interview him and interview all these other musicians about him. And as I say, create this incredible story about him. And it's such a moving, I mean, of course, I know a lot of the characters in the film either personally or I know who they are, but it's such a great window into this incredibly unique world and circumstance that Super Chicken comes from, that when people are listening to, I don't know, Eric Clapton's Crossroads or whatever, they don't necessarily understand the root of the music, or they don't understand that the root of the music is still alive today where it started.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what your documentary and the great from the early 90s, the great Deep Blues documentary does as well. It's a reminder to us from before that the music is not only alive in Mississippi from the past, but it's alive today in its own cool, unique, folky, down-home, scrabbly, and quite politically complicated, oppressed, impoverished, unfair way that it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's all those issues.
You remind us in your film of that important thing, that while the rest of us are flying all around the world and playing festivals, playing Black music, that Black music has its root in the Black experience. And there are living Black blues artists today of all ages that are carrying on the tradition and need to be appreciated and understood as the rest of us, either as fans or musicians, benefit from its bounty.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
That's such a nice way to tie all these pieces together, you know, like this constant evolution. And it's easy to put things in amber, you know, and think this is what that means at that particular time, but like what you're doing, keeping Hamlet is alive and the blues alive, like all that stuff, it keeps moving forward in this, you know.
That's also what I love about your film, because it is an appropriate, I mean Deep Blues was a movie that completely flipped my lid. I had no idea about Junior Kimbra, all these guys going. I went into a movie theater in Montreal, a Rep House Cinema, and I watched it in, you know, 1993 or 4, and I was like, what is going on, man? I got no idea about any of this. And in your guys' film is a beautiful kind of postscript to that movie, and reminding us now about what's going on, not just in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah. It's funny you say about Junior Kimbra, because when we first got to Clarksdale, it was during the Juke Joint Festival, and they had music kind of going all over the place. And the very, very first person we met was the grandson of Junior Kimbra. And I was like, what? This can't be right. And I'm like, it is. It's Kimbra. And just started talking away to him. So it was because I remember how, you know, that film Deep Blues, yeah, made a huge impact on me as well. And actually getting to know the filmmaker.
Amazing.
Over the last couple of years. Yeah, Robert Mudgee, who, you know, directed that incredible film all those years ago. That's been a very sort of full circle moment as well. But yeah, that was a thing. Getting to meet the sons and the grandsons of the guys that were in Deep Blues has been a very, very cool experience.
And Mark, we have to admit, as 50-year-old non-Black blues musicians, there's been a narrative for almost the whole history that we have played it, that Black people weren't into blues and that Black people weren't playing blues anymore, except for the old legends like the BB generation, the Buddy Guy generation, and all those masters who came before and who are gone. And Deep Blues reminded us that there is Mississippi blues alive today. It's not 1928 recordings of Robert Johnson only. And your film reminds us, with an artist like Super Chicken and some of the other artists we see, that contemporary Black blues music is alive, and it's something that needs to be embraced and understood and celebrated, because it is actually, the root has kept growing. And as opposed to a lot of the rest of us have been dealing in the branches, this is still the root. And I don't think it gets the recognition, appreciation, and it's not quite as understood as a lot of the other blues music that's become so popular, which I would argue is it's almost become other kinds of music. You know, it's almost become rock music, or it's become jazz music. But that deep, deep Mississippi thing, you're giving them a window into a world that is really special. And I really admire what you guys have done. And I love the film. I know I'm not the only one.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for much. To say. One last question, Raul. Where do you see yourself at Chicken's Age? What do you think in the next 20 years? Is there something that you've had a great career. You really have. But things that you've not done yet, or you people you'd like to work with, or what's your future ambitions and goals?
Well, not to be morbid, but I first of all, I hope I'm alive. I think, you know, we can't take that for granted. And so I generally don't look much further ahead than a very short time. Also, you know, one of the joys of being in the arts is that, you know, your trajectory can change depending on the experience you have. Like that happens in acting all the time. You know, I get some job and all of a sudden, you know, like I said, I'm working with an Academy Award winner going like, oh, wow, I hadn't worked for 11 months and now I'm with this person who's got Oscars. That's cool. So, you know, I really don't look too far ahead because I don't really know what life or this profession or professions will bring. You know, I guess there's part of what drives me, to be honest, is that I still think more of the world should know and see what I can do. That's kind of the only piece that's missing. I don't care that much about money. I mean, I got enough to get by. I'd love not to be impoverished. I hope we're not in any kind of crazy world war in the next little while. That would be nice too. Those will change all our priorities. Those will change all our circumstances, as great wars have in the century before. Yeah. But if we can avoid all that, you know, I just hope that 20 years from now, more people appreciate or know or have seen what I can do. Honestly, that's probably it.
And that's the best thing. There's always going to be an audience you haven't met, you know?
Yes.
What a good reason to keep going.
And as more of my audience dies, it's probably appropriate.
True enough. Raul, this has been great, man. I'd like to thank you so much, dude, for being part of this.
I'm honored to be your first guest.
Well, thanks very much for doing that.
Chat soon, guys. Thanks.
Brian, that was a great conversation. It really was. So much to take away from all of that. What did you think?
It was such a treat, wasn't it, Mark? You know, Raul's such a fascinating guy, and he's just such a consummate professional in so many ways.
Yeah, no, he totally is. And I think something that I took away from that was, having known him for so many years, I've never heard him talk just so personally about how much it means to have committed himself to being an actor and a musician for all these years. And it really is. It is such a commitment, and it's such a journey. And I think, to me, he's really straddled both of these worlds very, very well. I mean, for him, they both feed each other completely. He needs the music just as much as he needs the acting to creatively keep himself going and to keep satisfied.
Absolutely. I think it really speaks volumes about just the amount of time and effort and energy he's put into his performing career over these last couple of decades. You know, it'd be really easy to overlook just how much work that has actually been. But he just makes it sound so easy. And, you know, he's got all these fascinating stories. He's such a wealth of knowledge. You know, it was just absolutely brilliant to listen to him.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, I hope everybody who listened to this enjoyed it as much as we did. And we'll see you all next time with a brand new interview in the between.